Israel presents.
Come in. Welcome.
Shalom and welcome to another issue of Torah Tidbits Audio. I'm your host, Phil Chernofsky. This show is for Parshat B'Shalach. The Shabbat is also known as Shabbat Shira, the Shabbat of the song. We'll go over a whole bunch of things related to that. Recording and first broadcast is Yom Chamishi, Thursday, Yud Aleph Shvat, the 11th of Shvat, 5769, February 5th. It is a sad day in the Jewish world. Today, Rabbi Noach Weinberg, Zichrono Livracha, passed away. The funeral is taking place, I think, as I record these words, and will have taken place by the time you're listening to them. He was the founder and longtime Rosh Yeshiva of Eish HaTorah, a school and a person who has had a tremendous, tremendous influence on the lives of many, many, many Jews, and he will be missed. Psalm 130, Tehillim Kuf Lamed, Shir HaMa'alot Mima'amakim Karaticha Adonai. Adonai Shema Vakoli, Tihyena Aznecha Kashuvot Lokol Tachanunai. Im Avonot Tishmoria, Adonai Mia Amod. Ki Imacha Hasalicha Lama'an Tivare. Ki Viti Adonai Kivata Nafshi, Velidvaro Hocholti. Nafshi Ladonai, Mi Shomerim Laboker, Shomerim Laboker. Yachel Yisrael El Adonai, Ki Im Adonai Hachesed Vaharbe Imo Fedut. Vehu yifdeh et Yisrael mikol avonotav. Achenu kol beit Yisrael hanetunim batzara uvashivya ha'omedim bein bayam uvein bayabasha. Hamakom yirachem aleihem v'yotzieim mitzara lirvacha umeafela leora umishibud legeula hashta ba'agala uvizman kariv v'nomar amen.
Bye.
just as an over-review or a re-overview, in the Parsha of Shemot, the Torah describes Bnei Yisrael being oppressed and enslaved in Egypt, Moshe Rabbeinu being born, and him getting involved with the people. The vision of the burning bush is there, the prophecy that it is Moshe who will be instrumental in taking the Jews out of Egypt. In Parshat Vaera, that promise and that prophecy is given to the people, and warnings are given to Paro, and the Makot begin. In Parshat Vaera, we had the first 7 out of 10 plagues, Dom, Tzvardea, Kinim, Orov, Dever, Shechin, and Barad. In Parshat Bo, last week's reading, we find the last 3 Makot of Arbe, the locust, Choshech, darkness, and Makat Bechorot, the smiting of the firstborns. And we have the mitzvot related to Yetziat Mitzrayim, to the Exodus, Korban Pesach, Chametz and Matzah, a few other mitzvot tied in, and the description of the Jewish people leaving the land of Egypt. In this week's Sedra, they are on their way out. Calendar-wise, our tradition is that Kriyat Yamsuf, the splitting of the sea, took place on the 7th day of Pesach. Yetziat Mitzrayim, of course, is the 1st day of Pesach. So we are roughly later in the week following leaving Egypt from last week. And we have the events where Paro and the Egyptians decide they made a mistake allowing the Jews to leave, and they pursue. What follows are the events of Kriyat Yamsuf, the splitting of the sea, the salvation of the Jewish people, and their recognition and acknowledgement to God of the great miracles which they had witnessed, and the fact that God had saved them completely from Egypt, removed them from Egypt, and saved them from the Egyptian taskmasters. The Song of the Sea is unique. It is unique in the way it is written on a Torah scroll, a special format which no other part of the Torah has. It is special because it was God's incorporation of our song into His Torah, so to speak. You can look at it in general that all of the Torah is God's words dictated to Moshe, and Uz Yashir, the Song of the Sea, is a verbatim transcript of the song that was sung by the Jewish people at the sea. The significance of this portion is perpetuated in the fact that every day in the prayers we have Shirat Hayam, Oz Yashir. It is at the end of Psukei Dezimra, immediately prior to Kriyat Shema and its Brachot, and it contains phrases and verses and words that are familiar because it is part of our daily prayer. All right, let me see if I could explain what's bothering me without coming out too negative. We have miracles that have been described in Shmot, Vaera, Bo, Beshalach, next week Parshat Yitro with Revelation at Sinai, descriptions filled with wonders and miracles. And yet, there's something bothersome, and maybe I'll try to get there. The miracles at the sea, culminating in the Song of the Sea, are accompanied by a phrasing that Israel saw the mighty hand that God performed for them in Egypt. The people feared God, Vaya'aminu Bashem, they believed in him, uv Moshe avdo, and in Moshe, his servant. Very nice. This verse that I quoted describes a very, very high level of belief. But the question is, how strong? High level, yes. Momentary, for sure. How enduring is it? And how solid is it? Why do I ask? Because after the Song of the Sea, the Torah makes a point of saying that Moshe led the people on their journey from Yam Suf, and they went to Midbar Shur, and they went for 3 days in the wilderness, and they didn't find water. They came to Maratah, and they couldn't drink the water that they found there because it was too bitter. That's where the place got its name. And they complained to Moshe, and they said, "What are we going to drink?" And they screamed out to God, and he showed them, or Moshe, a certain stick which he was to throw into the water, and it became drinkable. We have repeated examples in the Torah from the moment we came out of Egypt, turned around and said, "What, there are not enough graves in Egypt, you had to take us out to kill us here in the Midbar." Now, on the one hand, I understand panic. I understand the reaction of a people that have had generations of oppression and slavery, and it is very, very hard to go against that ingrained feeling of dread. But still, look what they saw in Egypt. Look what they saw with the plagues. They saw devastating plagues rain down on Egypt, and in stark contrast, total peace and calm and tranquility in the Jewish camp. That should have impressed them enough so that a couple of days out of Egypt, they shouldn't say such a terrible, terrible thing like, "What, there are not enough burial places in Egypt, you had to take us out." Here, after the miracle upon miracle, within miracle, on top of miracles of the splitting of the sea, 3 days, true, they're thirsty, but the way that you complain and the way that you ask, and what did they think, that God would let them die of thirst after having done all that he had done? It bothers me a lot. And I'm certainly not the only one. And it's bothered me for years. I had a sobering experience, which I might have shared in a previous show. Many, many years ago, driving down to Eilat and stopping off in Timna Valley, where King Solomon's copper mines are. I remember getting out of the car and walking around a hill, purposely looking for a spot that I wouldn't be able to see my car, and I wouldn't be able to see any sign of modern human inhabitants. No houses, no wiring, no nothing. I found it. And I stood there for 5 minutes, and for 5 minutes it was a wonderful kind of experience. After 5 minutes, or maybe it took 10, I broke out in a sweat, and I had a momentary panic. What if I can't find my car? What if I run out of water? What if I can't find my way back to the road? What if I can't find help? This was the day before cell phones. And at that moment of momentary panic, I realized what B'nai Israel, the people of Israel, went through in a totally different context, obviously. But when you're thirsty, you're thirsty. And when you haven't had water for 3 days, you're very thirsty. And you're perhaps on the verge of dehydration or dying of thirst. And miracles that you experienced don't quench your thirst. So I do understand it. On the other hand, it very, very much bothers. I don't know if this is getting across at all. But it is just something. Look, on Kriyat Yam Suf, the splitting of the sea, we have a famous saying that a simple maidservant saw more of God's miracles revealed at the sea than Yechezkel Hanavi, Ezekiel the prophet, saw in his most vivid prophecies. Part of the answer is that generation didn't come into Israel, or the men at least. They died out in a period of 40 years of wandering. Officially, it was the sin of the spies, which condemned the people to wandering, but there was also the fact that it takes a generation to get out of that slave mentality, and a whole new way of thinking and approaching things was necessary for the difficult years ahead of conquest and settling the land. But that's not even the main point that I want to bring out. And this, to me, what I'm about to say, is something I have spoken about in the past, and to me it's very, very significant. I am fascinated by the description of miracles, and I can only try to imagine what things must have been like to witness them. On the other hand, I believe that we, living today, witness miracles upon miracles in daily life. I'm talking about even different kinds. I'm talking about the things where you say, wow, that was a miracle, because we just went through a war where the other side had 1,300 casualties and we had 13 casualties. That's a miracle. When you hear a report of a rocket landing and exploding, no one hurt, no one injured, minimal damage, that's a miracle. Of course, it would be nicer if we didn't have rockets fired at us. A lot of things would be nicer, but that's one type of miracle. But I also want to talk about another type of miracle. When was the last time you ate an apple? An apple is a miracle. A long time ago, someone planted an apple tree, and year after year after year, that tree now gives a harvest of delicious apples. I don't mean delicious apples, I mean good-tasting apples. Could be delicious, could be all other kinds, Granny Smith, whatever. If the miracle of the sea, I'm jumping a little now, if the miracle of the sea was V'hamayim lahem choma, the wall, the water was like walls, miminamu mismolam, to their right and to their left, and they were walking on dry land between two walls of water, then that was a momentary miracle. But what about the miracle of water? Water, normal, everyday water, is a miracle. We happen to be feeling an acute lack of rain this winter in Israel. Other places are being devastated by terrible weather conditions and heavy rains and snows. I don't want to get into that. I'm talking about an objective portrayal of water as an amazing gift from God, and that's a miracle. If you don't like the word miracle, use a different word. Some people think miracle only in the narrow sense of something that is supernatural. I believe that we are missing more than half of the picture of what a miracle is if we don't include the natural. The birth of a child. Animals. I just wrote this week, I have a column in Torah Tidbits called Morabu Masecha Hashem, How Many Are Your Creations, O God? And I feature usually an animal and something interesting where a person's reaction is, amazing world that God created us with. So this week I wrote about the echidna, E-C-H-I-D-N-A, echidna. Echidna is a mammal, but it is not a placental mammal, meaning an animal that develops its young in a womb, in a placenta, and then gives birth to a live young. It is not even a marsupial, a pouched animal, which also give birth to a very immature offspring, which then is further developed within the pouch of the mother. The echidna is one of two oviparous mammals, egg-laying mammals, the duck-billed platypus, which I think gets a little bit more press coverage, and the echidna. And the echidna, after about 21 days, 3 weeks after conception, lays a soft, leathery egg the size of a grape, which the mother puts into her own pouch, where 10 days later the egg hatches, and there is a tiny baby echidna, known as a puggle, P-U-G-G-L-E. That puggle is smaller than a jelly bean, and it develops further within the pouch, nursing from the mother, lapping up the milk that the mother secretes from glands without even nipples into the pouch. And after a total, I think, of 55 days or so, the mother deposits the puggle into a nursery burrow that she dug for it, and visits every 5 to 10 days to continue nursing, and at 7 months total, which is less than the gestation of a human being, 7 months after conception, the puggle is now a little echidna on its own, and develops from there, keeps going from there. That's a miracle. That's an amazing thing. Nah, that's nature. Yeah, but what do you think nature is? But I think that's part of the point. We need the flashy, one-of-a-kind kind of miracles in order to help us focus back to the everyday miracle. I'll talk more about this in a moment.
I'm Rod Sterling. You're listening to
Torah Tidbits Audio.
Rest your eyes.
We were using Parshat Beshalach as a launch to take a look at miracles. Let's call them even the pros and cons of miracles. They're very impressive. They make their point. Sometimes they serve a purpose, a practical purpose. And very often their effect on the people is sadly short-lived. In other words, and I don't know if I'm saying this too much, I'm trying to say it in a different way, the Vayaaminu Bashem uvMoshe Avdo, that they believed in Moshe and God, maybe the Rambam puts it in a context when he says the basis of our belief in God, or the main event that solidifies, epitomizes our belief in God, is Ma'amad Har Sinai, revelation at Sinai, the receiving of the Torah. Even if you look, I apologize for jumping, but I hope the whole thing will be put into context, or be understood in context. First prophecy to Moshe at the burning bush, I spoke about it a number of weeks ago, included the use of the word, this is a sign, in two very different ways. One, actually two, God gives Moshe signs to impress upon the people and upon Paro that God sent Moshe to speak to them. And one was to throw down his staff and it would turn into a snake, or a crocodile, a nachash, tanin, whatever. One that his hand would be put into his cloak and come out, and it would be leprous, and put it back, and it would clear. And the other was to take water, pour it on the ground, and it would turn to blood. And then the word oat, sign, is used differently. This will be the sign, says God to Moshe, that I have sent you to take my people out, that after you come out of Egypt, you will return to this very spot, Mount Sinai, to serve me, capital M. Now, those are very, very different in quality. One is akin, I don't mean to be disrespectful, but it's akin to a parlor trick. The other is very, very substantial. The miracles that were wrought, according to some opinions, were only for practical reasons. The sea was split to provide passage for the Jewish people and to drown the Egyptians. It was not just meant to entertain or amaze. It did have that effect. But the emuna, the faith belief that you have in God, is not dependent upon those kind of miracles. Creation, and that which violates the laws of creation. There's a whole analysis, for example, in commentaries about how each one of the 10 plagues, aside from being a punishment for Egypt, was a display of a reversal of nature. We'll use one of the classic examples when the Torah describes the frogs were everywhere, in this room, in that room, all over the place, and even in your ovens. Commentaries say frogs don't by nature jump into an oven. That's part of the supernatural. Hail is made of layers of ice. The fact that the hail that rained down upon Egypt had fire inside, encased in ice, is me'al lateva, supernatural. The arba, locust, a normal or a natural phenomenon, but in the way that it was supernatural. Darkness is very part of nature, but not the darkness of Egypt. The darkness of plague number 9 was a different quality of darkness. So that the conclusion is the same God and only God who created the world and all of nature and all of the laws of nature can defy the laws of nature when he so chooses, as demonstrated by the Makot, as demonstrated by any other open, obvious miracle. Shemesh Begivon Dom. I'm jumping again, but on purpose. Let the sun stand still and the moon stand still. This is what Joshua, Yehoshua, asked of God while he was in battle. He needed more daylight time to continue the battle, and God went along with it, to the point where the book of Joshua tells us it was the only time ever that God responded to a human demand of that nature. But what does that tell us? What does it mean that the sun stood still? I don't know. But let's say we take it literally, and it means the earth stopped rotating without the devastating effect of stopping rotation. You know, a miracle is a miracle, so it could include that also. And then it went back to normal. But the normal sun of sunrise, sunset, every single day, of the energy from the sun and the light from the sun and the warmth from the sun and all of the features of if we were closer, we would burn up, and if we were further away, it would be too cold to sustain life. These are all miracles. Those are the miracles of creation. So that's a package deal. We are dealing with one God, the God that created the world of nature and the supernatural, the world of miracles in nature and miracles outside of nature. That, in my book, is more significant and substantial than any flashy, momentary mitzvah. Because even if we're thirsty, And even if we don't have water to drink, we at least are armed with the knowledge that this is the world that God created, and he has his rhyme and reason and methods for doing what he does. And I feel very comfortable in Vayaaminu Bashem Uv Moshe Avdo to apply to us, for us to internalize and personalize our belief in God based upon the miracles which we perceive in everyday life. Another example, I mentioned Hanukkah time. A one-day supply of oil miraculously lasted 8 days, that's a miracle. A one-day supply of oil that lasts one day, that's a miracle. Different kind of miracle. That you could take olives and extract the oil from it and put a wick in the oil and light it at the tip and you get a beautiful constant flame is a miracle of nature. When a one-day supply miraculously lasts for 8 days, then you're stepping outside of nature, and that's a miracle too. But the combination is really the strength. The strength of our being able to perceive God's presence in this world, not just in a miraculous event that goes outside of nature, but in every aspect of nature as well. Then you're seeing God full time. And that's the goal. To say that once upon a time, a long time ago, God wrought miracles on behalf of the Israelites against the Egyptians and against the Canaanites and against the Amalekites, all of that is fine. But the fact is, today, yesterday, today, and tomorrow, miracles are happening all the time. We view God, we describe God as HaMechadesh B'Tuvo B'Chol Yom Tamid Ma'aseh V'Reshit. He, in his goodness, renews the acts of creation every single day. That, again I say, from a personal perspective, is more impressive than the splitting of the sea. Go back to a tree. A tree grows, it provides roots which hold the soil together, preventing soil erosion. It provides shade, it provides nesting place for birds, it provides fruits for us, and leaves, and bark, and everything else. Beautiful smelling flowers in many trees, and all kind of good things. These are manifestations of God in this world. And when it's not just, well, 3 days ago a miracle happened, and now I'm having my questions and my doubts because it's 3 days later and things aren't going well, is a very different and sad kind of reaction to a situation where a person acknowledges the existence of God in every single thing he does and observes in this world. And I could even go the step further and say, just like we have a halacha, kishem shemivarchim al hatov, just like we bless God for good that happens, kach mivarchim al hara, so too are we obligated to bless God when something that we perceive as bad happens. And that's because God is full time in supervision of this world. I was going to say enough said, I don't think it's enough said, but it will be for now. I want to change abruptly now, and then we'll get back to the Parsha. I'm about to play a 5.5 minute clip of a stand-up comedy routine, one that I've always liked. Your challenge, because I'm not going to explain why, I'm not going to tell you who did it, your challenge is to explain why I am placing this clip on this week's show. If you email me with the answer, the first, maybe let's say the first three that give me the correct answer will receive CDs from Noam Productions. The address to respond is tt torahtidbits@ou.org. That's the easiest email to remember. The question, first, I'd like you to enjoy this comedy routine. Second, to tell me why I put it in stuck like coming out of nowhere. So, as I said, first, enjoy it. And second, see if you could figure out what it's doing specifically in this week's show. And after it, we'll talk more about the content of Parshat Beshalach.
The most publicized figure today is the astronaut. He is the hero of the 20th century. Our astronauts are highly intelligent, disciplined, and skilled. They've been subjected to the most rigorous testing and training in the history of aviation. But do we know everything about them? I don't think so. After all, they're human, and as human beings, they have their own individual quirks which no amount of testing can uncover. So, keeping this in mind, let's go to Cape Canaveral, where an astronaut is about to be launched into space.
Captain Cartwright, this is Control calling Captain Cartwright. This is Control calling Captain Cartwright.
This is Captain Cartwright, Control.
Captain, we're minus 4 minutes. Give me your final cockpit check.
Roger, Control. Oxygen tanks filled. Automatic gyro controls activated. Boosters ready. Instruments all checked. Yes, everything is set. Wait a minute. Wait just a minute.
Is there anything wrong, sir?
Yes, I can't find my crayons.
Can't find your what, sir?
My crayons. Somebody took my crayons.
For a minute, I thought you said somebody took your crayons, sir.
That's what I said. Who the heck's been in here?
Well, just the ground crew, sir, but I don't think...
But nothing. Why should a guy take another guy's crayon?
Sir, are you sure they're lost?
Maybe they... Control, I know when I lost my crayon. Somebody stole them. I left them right next to my Hansel and Gretel coloring book.
Sir, are they really that important?
Important? What the heck good's a coloring book without crayons?
Well, I could send one of the men down to the PX to buy you another box of crayons.
Nothing doing. I want my crayons.
Minus 3 minutes.
I ain't going anywhere without my crayons.
Well, just a minute, sir.
Attention on the launching pad. Attention on the launching pad. A box of crayons is missing from the Atlas VI. These crayons are the personal property of Captain Cartwright.
My mother gave me those crayons.
His mother gave him those crayons.
That was personal, Control. You didn't have to tell him that.
Scratch his mother. All ground personnel spread out and police the area for a box of crayons.
Sir, I think they picked up something.
Are they crayons? Wonderful.
Ask them if there's a green, an orange, and two blacks in it.
Is there a green, an orange, and two blacks in it?
There's no orange, sir.
Then they're not my crayons.
What the devil's going on here, Control? What's holding up the works? Oh, General, I was just about to call you, sir. It's Captain Cartwright. He can't find his crayons.
Can't find his what, Sergeant?
His crayons, and he won't take off without them, sir.
Crayons? Are they important, Sergeant?
Important? What the heck was a coloring book without crayons, sir?
You're all gone out of your mind. Hand me that microphone, Control. Captain Cartwright, this is General Ross. I order you to stop this nonsense about a stupid box of crayons and prepare for takeoff.
Well, General, maybe you better get yourself another box.
Now, wait a minute, Jimmy baby. Let's forget about rank for a second.
Okay, Seymour.
Jimmy boy, do you realize the importance of this flight? For 10 years, the government has spent billions of dollars preparing for this big moment. Jimmy,
People all over the free world are anxiously awaiting the results of this flight. Don't you realize what that means? You're about to become a national hero, Jimmy. What more do you want?
I want my crayon, that's all I want.
Captain, we don't have your... Wait a minute, Jimmy, baby. Would you be interested in a nice tinker toy?
General, who the devil do you think you're dealing with, a kid?
Now, look here...
Minus 1 minute.
Professor Von Strom, you designed the ship. Maybe you can talk to him.
Yes, of course. Perhaps I can persuade him. Probably just nerves, huh? May I have the microphone, please? Captain Cartwright. Yeah, what do you want, Professor? Captain, you have relatives now living in Germany? No, I don't, Professor. Well, I tried, General. Used to work in the old days.
Minus 30 seconds.
Now, either I get my crayons or else.
10, 9, 8.
You guys can count from today till tomorrow, but...
6, 5, 4.
I got
3, 2.
Wait a minute, fellas.
Fire!
I want my crayons.
In the Haggadah at the Seder, we sing Dayenu. One of the lines in Dayenu is, Ilu natan lanu et ha-shabbat, had you given us the Shabbat, velo kervanu lifnei har Sinai, and not brought us to Sinai, where we were to receive the whole Torah, Dayenu. We would have sufficient cause to acknowledge and to thank God. The question is, if Shabbat is part of Torah, part of revelation at Sinai, in fact, commandment number 4 is Shabbat, then what do we mean when we say in the song, in the poem, if you had given us Shabbat and not brought us to Sinai, Dayenu? The answer is that Shabbat was something we received prior to arriving at Sinai as a serious down payment, or a serious preview, better word, a preview of our obligations and privileges, let's combine it, from that the Torah will be giving us. And we received Shabbat in a place called Rephidim a couple of weeks before we arrived at Sinai, and specifically in the context of the man, the food from heaven. The Torah tells us that the people were hungry. God says to Moshe, they will see how I will take care of them. And to cut some of the story out, they were to be instructed that in the morning they would find a miraculous food, let's say, from heaven, known as man. Actually, according to the Torah, the people gave the name man to what it was. And this was to be collected in what a person and a family would need for the day's sustenance, and nothing was to be left over for the next morning. Part of a slave's mentality when he gets a morsel of food is to put most of it away and save it and eat a minimal amount on the spot because he does not know where he's getting his next food. A free person in this context has to learn, or let's just say we have to learn, trust, faith, confidence in God. And one of the ways he tested the people was to give them the man specifically that gets used up in the course of one day. Anything that's left over dissipates, so that it is a fresh manifestation of God's gift and our trust in him when we don't leave over from one day till the next. The Torah reports that people did leave over, but the majority believed. Then came the first Friday, and Moshe had to tell the people, you'll notice that this time you'll be able to collect a double amount that which you will be able to use on Friday and that which you will save and prepare for Shabbat, because on Shabbat the mun does not fall. People went out looking for it on Shabbat morning and they didn't find anything. Fine. Aside from the lack of belief, the mun was a very strong test and of belief and confirmation that it is wise for us to believe in God. There's a lot more to be said. I didn't get a chance to talk about the custom of feeding birds on Erev Shabbat Shira, which should be done. I didn't talk much about three meals on Shabbat, which we get from the mun, and a whole bunch of other things. We'll have to save it for another time. All I could do now is wish you a Shabbat Shalom, Lehishtameah.